Pull up a chair. July of 1942. 8 aircraft are crossing the North Atlantic eastbound, bound for Britain. 2 Boeing B-17 Flying Fortresses and 6 Lockheed P-38 Lightnings. Operation Bolero. The big push to get American air power across the pond and into the fight. Aircrews young enough to still believe nothing could go wrong, something went wrong. The weather closed in over the Greenland ice cap. Weather in that part of the world does not negotiate. It moves fast and it moves hard, and on July 15th it moved hard on that 8-ship formation. They diverted, they tried to find clear air, and eventually one by one they sat down, not on a runway, not on a grass strip, on the ice cap itself. The Greenland ice cap, which covers roughly 700,000 square miles and in places runs more than 10,000 feet deep, every single crew member survived. That part of the story has a good ending, at least for the men. The airplanes were a different matter. They sat on the ice. The crews were rescued. The Army Air Forces looked at the logistics of recovering 8 aircraft from the middle of the Greenland ice sheet during a world war, calculated that it was not going to happen, and walked away. The planes stayed. Season after season, they collected snow. Snow compresses to ice, ice moves, and the Greenland ice cap does not give things back without a fight. By the 1980s, those 8 aircraft were buried under more than 200 feet of ice and moving slowly, inexorably, toward the coast. I'm Tail Dragger. This is Radio Hangar, and this is The Hangar. Tonight we are talking about Glacier Girl. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, the recovery in the 1980s. A couple of Atlanta businessmen with a shared passion for aviation history and a level of ambition that bordered on the unreasonable started asking a question. Those aircraft are still out there, under the ice. How do you get one back?
Patrick Epps and Richard Taylor formed what they called the Greenland Expedition Society. That name is underselling it considerably. This was not a society for people who enjoy Greenland. This was a group of pilots and enthusiasts who were genuinely going to go to one of the most inhospitable places on the planet, find aircraft buried under the ice, and bring one home. Step one was finding them. They contracted a magnetometer survey of the area where the aircraft went down. Magnetometers measure variations in the Earth's magnetic field, and a buried aluminum airframe, even under 200 feet of ice, leaves a signature you can read if you know what you're looking for. They found the formation, or what was left of it. The aircraft had moved with the ice, shifted, compressed, but they were there. Step two was the part nobody had a great answer for. How do you access something buried under 268 feet of solid ice? You melt your way in. The team developed what they called Super Gopher. Now the name sounds like something you would find bolted to a workbench in someone's garage, but Super Gopher was a purpose-built thermal melt probe, essentially a heated lance lowered on a cable, designed to melt a channel straight down through the ice, slowly, foot by foot. Think about what that means in practice. You're standing on top of the Greenland ice cap, which is cold enough to generate its own weather systems. You're melting a shaft down through more than 260 feet of glacial ice that has been packing itself tighter for decades. And then, once you get down there, you're going to try to get an airplane out. Multiple expeditions, multiple years, multiple setbacks. The ice cap is not cooperative. You melt a shaft, and if you leave it too long, it starts to close back up. The logistics of operating up there are brutal. Every piece of equipment, every gallon of fuel, every person has to get there somehow. You're not driving a truck to the job site. They finally broke through to one of the P-38s in 1992, 50 years after those wheels first touched the Greenland ice. Now here's where it gets interesting.
When Super Gopher reached the aircraft, what the team found was both remarkable and sobering. The P-38, which had landed upright on the ice in 1942, was now on its side, compressed and distorted by decades of ice movement and pressure that is genuinely difficult to comprehend until you sit down and do the math on what the weight of 268 feet of glacial ice does to a structure over time. The ice cap does not store things gently. It stores them the way a glacier stores boulders. The cockpit was crushed. The twin booms, that signature twin boom configuration that makes the P-38 impossible to mistake for anything else in the sky, were bent and deformed. Parts of the wing structure were crumpled, and yet, the basic structure was there. The major components were recoverable. The Allison engines, liquid-cooled V-12s producing more than 1,000 horsepower each, were surprisingly intact. Aluminum and steel do not rot in the conventional sense. Buried in ice, in the dark, with minimal oxygen circulation, those aircraft had been preserved in a way that nothing left outside in the elements could ever be. The team melted a large cavity around the aircraft, large enough to work in, and then piece by piece, they brought that P-38 up through the shaft. Wings, fuselage, engines, landing gear, all of it came up over weeks of work in conditions that did not particularly care about the schedule or the budget or anyone's comfort. When everything finally reached the surface and was loaded onto aircraft for the trip home, they had a P-38 battered, compressed, twisted in places, but recoverable. The aircraft was acquired by Roy Schaffner, who funded the restoration project, and what followed was one of the most demanding warbird restorations ever attempted. Let me tell you what it means to restore a P-38 that spent 50 years under 268 feet of glacial ice. First, you have to understand what you actually have. That means a complete teardown and inspection of every component. Every rib, every spar, every frame, every fitting. You're looking for cracks, for metal fatigue from the pressure, for corrosion, where moisture found a way in, for distortion that may look minor on the bench, but will matter enormously at altitude and at speed.
The P-38 in its original form was already a complex aircraft. Lockheed's twin-engine, twin-boom fighter was pushing engineering boundaries when it was designed in the late 1930s by a team that included Hall Hibbard and a young Kelly Johnson, who would later run the Skunk Works and give us the U-2 and the SR-71. The P-38 was not simple in any sense. It was complicated in ways that single-engine fighters were not. Complicated means a lot of systems. Hydraulics for the landing gear and the flaps, turbochargers on both engines, counter-rotating props to eliminate torque, which was a genuine engineering solution to a real handling problem. Intercoolers, a tricycle gear at a time when most fighters were still tail draggers, which I admit gives me mixed feelings on a personal level. When you're restoring a P-38 from essentially nothing, you're sourcing parts from a supply chain that stopped operating in 1945. Some things you machine from scratch, some things you find in parts caches and museum storage and private collections around the country, some things you fabricate from original Lockheed engineering drawings, if you can track them down. Now imagine doing all of that with an airframe that has been compressed and twisted by the Greenland ice cap for half a century. The team had to straighten structures carefully, bringing metal back toward its original shape without introducing new cracks or new stress risers in the process. They had to rebuild the cockpit from essentially nothing. They had to overhaul both Allison engines, which meant sourcing parts for a power plant that has not been in production in decades. The B-1710 went into the early P-40 Warhawks, the Bell P-39 Aerocobra, and others' parts. Do not exactly fall off the shelf at your local engine overhaul shop. The counter-rotating arrangement in the P-38 was deliberate and clever. Left engine, turning left. Right engine, turning right. At low speed and high power, you were not fighting torque and P-factor the way you were in a single-engine fighter. For a pilot making a heavy, slow turn on final approach, that mattered. It made the P-38 more forgiving in the regime where a lot of fighters wanted to bite you.
The restoration took years, it consumed enormous resources, and along the way it became something bigger than one airplane. People followed this story, aviation historians, warbird enthusiasts. People who had never thought much about the P-38 looked up from what they were doing when they heard about an aircraft pulled out of the Greenland ice and said, "I need to know how that ends." In 2002, 60 years after those wheels touched ice for the last time, Glacier Girl flew. The P-38, wearing the olive drab and neutral gray of the wartime 8th Air Force, serial number 41-7630, lifted off and climbed away, clean and true. Two Allisons singing. I have watched the footage of that first flight more times than I will admit to in public. The sound of two Allison engines spooling up to power is something you either understand or you do not. It is not subtle. It is a howl that has a frequency to it. Something that finds a spot between your sternum and your spine and just stays there. And when she lifted off and started climbing, you could feel it even through a camera lens from 100 yards away. Glacier Girl has since flown at air shows across the country. She is airworthy. She is flying. That fact alone, given where this aircraft spent 50 years, is almost incomprehensible. But here's what I keep coming back to when I think about this story, beyond the engineering and the logistics and the extraordinary commitment of everyone who worked on this project over more than a decade. Those pilots in July of 1942 set their aircraft down on the Greenland ice cap because the weather left them no other choice. The weather made the decision. They survived, they went on. Some flew combat over Europe. Some came home. Some did not. The aircraft they left behind were part of the largest military and industrial effort in American history. Every P-38 that made it to Britain, every B-17 that flew the Schweinfurt raids, every fighter that escorted bombers deep into Germany was one piece of a machine so large. Most of us cannot hold it all in our heads at once. Glacier Girl did not make it to Britain in 1942.
She went into the ice instead, and she waited.
She waited while the men who flew her grew old. She waited while the generation that won that war came home and raised their families and aged. She waited while the warbird preservation movement slowly figured out what it was capable of, and then, 50 years later, some pilots with more stubbornness than common sense went and got her back. That is the warbird community at its best. It does not let the past stay buried. It goes down into the ice and brings it back up. My sources include reporting from Aviation Week and Space Technology on the recovery expeditions and documentation from the Greenland Expedition Society. More at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger, Blue Skies.